This special update of Undisclosed is brought to you by The Skim and ThreadUp. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
Welcome, listeners of Undisclosed. This is Rabia Chaudhary, and I'm back with my colleagues Susan Simpson and Colin Miller, and very excited to be back with the entire original team. And this week, we are interrupting the amazing Freddie Gray series that has been investigated and reported on by Amelia McDonald Perry and Justine Barron, and you've been listening to for a number of months now. And we're doing that to bring you two special episodes this week to update you both on the Adnan Syed case and the Joey Watkins case. We get a lot of questions about what is going on in both these cases, how and if they are proceeding, and how both Joey and Adnan are doing. And despite it looking all quiet on the front, there's actually a lot going on in the background in both cases. So in today's episode, we're going to focus on the state versus Adnan Syed. And then later this week, you're going to hear all about what's going on in Joey's case. Hi, Susan. Hi, Colin. Good to be back with you guys.
Hey, good to be back with you.
Yeah. So it's been a while since the last Adnan update. And for people who have not tuned in for a while or who are just catching on the show now and have not listened to our Adnan Syed material, here's a brief recap of what's going on in the case. Back in 2014, Serial aired. And in 2015, we began Undisclosed and continued investigation of the case. In October of 2015, the Court of Special Appeals in Maryland ruled that Adnan would get a new hearing on his petition for post-conviction relief. In that hearing, the two primary issues were, on the one hand, Asia McClain and the uninvestigated alibi, and secondly, the AT&T fax cover sheet regarding the use of cell phone pings at Adnan Syed's trial. That hearing took place in February 2016, and Judge Welch heard arguments and testimony for both the issues. So in order to grant Adnan a new trial, what Judge Welch needed to find was that both Christina Gutierrez acted unreasonably at trial and that her error or errors caused Adnan prejudice or undermined her confidence in the jury's verdict. In July of that year, 2016, Judge Welch found that Gutierrez acted unreasonably in failing to contact Asia as a potential alibi witness. But he didn't think her testimony would have swayed the jury because, ironically, he found Jay's testimony to be so unreliable about what had happened right after school that day that the judge didn't think that was what convinced the jury anyway. Instead, Judge Welch found that it was those cell tower pings that probably convinced the jury and could have swayed their verdict if the fax cover sheet had been introduced, stating that the incoming call records were not reliable for use to determine location. Therefore, because Judge Welch found that Gutierrez unreasonably failed to cross-examine the state's cell phone expert with that cover sheet, on June 30th, 2016, he overturned Adnan's convictions based on the cell tower issue, but not the Asia issue, and ordered a new trial for Adnan. The state appealed the finding, and Adnan's attorney, Justin Brown, cross-appealed on the Asia issue, which means both issues were again before the court on appeal. And these appeals will now be heard at the Court of Special Appeals, Maryland's Intermediate Appellate Court. In addition, during this time period, there was also a motion for bail filed with Judge Welch. That was denied, which was unsurprising. So bail was denied, but that's, again, not surprising and not damaging to Adnan's case or some kind of bad sign of what's to come. And it didn't deny bail for something like finding that Adnan was a danger to anyone. Instead, in applying for bail, the judge used sort of a time capsule review of the case based solely on what was presented at trial in 2000. So things that have happened since then, like Jay's statement number 8 or 9 or 10, wherever we are now, and the intercept interview, the lividity evidence, or other problems with the state's case, that was not before the judge and not what he based his decision on. The main reason why Judge Welch denied bail was that the case had been sent down to him by the Court of Special Appeals with explicit instructions to return the case after he ruled. This conclusion not only means that Adnan could seek bail again after the Court of Special Appeals rules, but for reasons we'll discuss later, it also means that the state might have a much worse shot at winning its appeal.
So Adnan's upcoming appeal hearing at the Court of Special Appeals, now that the judge has ruled and all these appeals are going to be happening on these issues, is coming up on June 8th, 2017, not far from now, at 2 p.m. This is going to happen in Annapolis, Maryland. Adnan is not going to be present, but the hearing is open to the public. And I urge people to come to hear the hearing, to see how this goes down, and also to show support for Adnan if you want to. Of course, Justin Brown is going to be representing Adnan, and we understand that Thiru Vignaraja, who was the Deputy Attorney General of Maryland and litigated for the PCR hearing, but then later left the Attorney General's office, well, he's back, and he's going to be arguing for the state. I just need to make a side note, because it's really odd that he did leave the Attorney General's office, go into private practice, and apparently has been loaned back to the state.
Yeah, I'm sure it's happened before, but I've never heard of a pro bono prosecutor.
Yeah. Colin, what do you think of that? I've never heard of this.
It makes a certain degree of sense, because he spent all the prep time preparing this for the PCR hearing, so he has this knowledge that a new attorney wouldn't, but it is certainly something you wouldn't expect to see on a regular basis.
I mean, it did make me wonder for a second if the attorney general was not as inclined to keep pursuing it, and Thiru said, no, I'll do it for free. Let me back. Anyway.
I think he was just super eager to do it, and they're not going to say no to it. It's just not a situation that commonly comes up.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, better the person you know than the person you don't, and I'm using the nice word. But anyway, so the hearing's going to be, it's going to be heard by a 3-judge panel. There isn't a jury. There's no witnesses. There's no testimony like that. It says both the attorneys will be arguing the issues, and the judges will question them. They've already been fully briefed. And so basically, the issues are what we're going to discuss today, the issues that are going to be before the Court of Special Appeals.
Yeah, so issue one is, did Adnan receive ineffective assistance of counsel based upon Christina Gutierrez's failure to contact prospective alibi witness Asia McClain? This is the issue that the defense lost at the PCR level, and so it's the issue that Justin has raised on cross-appeal. And as with all ineffective assistance claims, this is broken down into two questions. The first of those questions is whether Gutierrez acted unreasonably in failing to contact Asia. And in finding, in fact, that Gutierrez did act unreasonably, Judge Welch made several factual findings. So, for instance, he found, one, that Gutierrez was aware of the possible Asia alibi at least 6 months before Adnan's 2000 trial. Second, that no one from Gutierrez's team contacted Asia before that trial. And three, that Asia was credible when she testified that she saw Adnan at the library until about 2:40 p.m. on the day that Hay disappeared. Now, the first important thing to note is the Court of Special Appeals is exceedingly unlikely to disturb any of those factual findings. And the question of why goes to the factual context here. The judges in the Court of Special Appeals were not present at the PCR proceedings. They couldn't observe the demeanor of Asia McClain and other witnesses. And appellate court judges are loath to second guess the judge who was actually in the courtroom and could see everything before him. And so this is reflected in the standard review for factual findings. That standard in Maryland is known as the clearly erroneous standard review. And that means the Court of Special Appeals will only disturb Judge Welch's factual findings if they are found to be clearly erroneous. The Court of Special Appeals of Maryland defined this standard in its 2002 opinion in State v. Brooks, and here are the relevant quotes.
A clearly erroneous holding should be limited to a situation where, with respect to a proposition or a fact as to which the proponent bears the burden of production, the fact-finding judge has found such a proposition or fact without the evidences having established a prima facie basis for such a proposition or fact. A finding or fact should never be held to have been clearly erroneous simply because its evidentiary predicate is weak, shaky, improbable, or a 50-to-1 long shot. A holding of clearly erroneous is a determination as a matter of law that, even granting maximum credibility and maximum weight, there was no evidentiary basis whatsoever for the finding of fact. The concern is not with the frailty or improbability of evidentiary base, but with the bedrock non-existence of an evidentiary base. In other words, the court was holding, quite simply, the state is facing an uphill battle of almost Sisyphean proportions to get the Court of Special Appeals to second-guess Judge Welch on the facts themselves.
What's up? It's Amelia. Investigating and researching and interviewing and writing for Undisclosed has basically taken over my life. For a while there, it kind of gave me a great excuse to tune out a lot of what was going on in the world. But my dinner party conversation game has totally suffered. Plus, I don't like being out of touch with current events. There's just so much going on, and it's all happening so fast. It's hard to keep up without getting distracted, though. Thankfully, The Skim has made that so much easier for me. The Skim serves up the news right when I need it, in one simple email every single morning with style and no BS. It's fun, informative, and it's free. Covering politics, world events, sports, and entertainment, The Skim's quick 5-minute morning read ensures that I'll never again be left tongue-tied when asked about, for example, world politics. Like that one time when someone was asking me about the election in France and I thought they were offering me a macaroon. Oops. This is not a free trial. The Skim is always free, every day. Nothing to pay and only knowledge to gain. And if that doesn't do it for you, I've got one word. Oprah. She endorses The Skim. That's reason enough right there. Join over 5 million people who wake up with The Skim every morning. Sign up today at theskim.com/undisclosed and you'll be entered to win a $250 Visa gift card. That's theskim.com/undisclosed. The Skim with two M's, spelled The Skim, SKIMM.com/undisclosed. Sign up right now for The Skim and enter for your chance to win a $250 Visa gift card at theskim.com/undisclosed.
So the Court of Special Appeals is going to use what's known as a de novo review for Judge Welch's legal conclusions. And de novo is Latin for, quote, of new. And the standard is exactly what those words imply. It is a clean slate review, with the court looking at Judge Welch's legal conclusions with a fresh set of eyes and no deference to his rulings. And Judge Welch made two such rulings. One, that Gutierrez was unreasonable in failing to contact Asia McClain. Now, that's good for Adnan. He had two main pillars of support for this conclusion. First, Judge Welch cited to the opinion of the Court of Appeals in Maryland in Re Paris W, and several of the cases quote in that opinion for the conclusion that, quote, once a defendant identifies a potential alibi witness, it is unreasonable not to make some effort to contact the witness to ascertain whether their testimony would help the defense. I mean, really, common sense. So based on the factual findings mentioned a minute ago, it was easy for Judge Welch to find that Gutierrez acted unreasonably. Now, second, Judge Welch addressed the state's claims that Gutierrez might have read Asia's letters as offers to lie, and that there was evidence that Adnan might have even colluded with Asia to fabricate an alibi. According to Judge Welch, adopting this reasoning, quote, would require the court to retroactively supply reasoning that is contrary to the facts and the law. Specifically, he found that, quote, the state's theory would invite the court to entertain speculations about strategic decisions that counsel made in determining to forego investigating the potential alibi witness. Now, quick question, Colin. My understanding is that when there is a clear indication that an attorney made a strategic decision, and the court does not often second guess an attorney's strategy, right?
Yeah, exactly. And the key case here that was quoted in the Paris case was the Griffin case out of the Fourth Circuit that says, right, if we have an indication of strategy, we give deference to that. We're not going to second guess what the attorney did, but we're not going to make up these post hoc rationalizations and say, well, maybe the attorney did this or that. And that's exactly the analysis that Judge Welch applied here.
For me, it goes back to the hearing. And at some point, I don't remember when now, but during the hearing, Justin was talking and he said that the judge, when we met in your office a few weeks before now, you said the question you had was, why didn't Gutierrez contact Asia? That was what you wanted to know, what you wanted the hearing to show. But I think it's clear the hearing didn't show that, because at the end of the day, there just isn't a reason. She just didn't. She didn't act. She didn't think. She wasn't doing anything. The reason we can't figure out why she didn't do this, and the reason why Theory was left just making up all kinds of explanations that maybe could have happened in some reality somewhere, is that Gutierrez just dropped the ball. She was sick. She was ill. She did nothing for no reason at all.
Yeah, I think it's important for folks. They might not realize that what happened with the defense files, and normally defense files, Gutierrez's files, in Adnan's case, you know, they'd be privileged, attorney-client confidentiality. Nobody can, you know, the state cannot access them. But because they had essentially become public, really, they were being passed through all of our hands, and we publicly posted many of them, that privilege no longer applied. So the state, Theo Vignaraja, the prosecutor, was able to get the full defense, a copy of the full defense file, and he must have combed through it looking for evidence.
He did. He absolutely did.
That she was making some kind of strategic decision. He wasn't really able to find the evidence because it doesn't exist, and he certainly couldn't convince the judge of that. So, so This then takes us to the state's recent brief to the Court of Special Appeals, where the state seems to be making the same argument in hopes of finding a more sympathetic set of ears. In the brief, the state makes three arguments. First, Gutierrez might have foregone contacting Asia because her alibi was risky and refutable, as compared to Gutierrez's strategy of presenting a habit alibi that involved Adnan staying on campus until track practice.
Yeah, and then the state's second argument is pretty much analogous to trying to shoot the moon in the card game Hearts. And that's because, according to the state now, the state's case at trial had what the state refers to as a flaw or a gap. Specifically, the state acknowledges it was unclear how Adnan got into Hayes' car after school, and they note how two state's witnesses, athletic trainer Inez Butler and Hayes' classmate Debbie, both saw Hay after school by herself. So the state's claim basically is that Asia's testimony actually could have resolved this flaw and closed this gap by establishing that Hay might have driven away from the school alone, but then picked up Adnan from the library before turning onto Woodlawn Drive. Now, this argument doesn't seem to make much sense because Inez Butler testified that Hay ran up to her concession stand between 2:15 and 2:20 p.m. and was in such a hurry to leave school that she didn't even have time to pay for the item she purchased. So given this, if Judge Welch was right that Asia credibly testified to seeing Adnan at the library next to the high school until 2:40 p.m., how does the state's timeline make any sense? Because that would mean that after Inez saw Hay leaving school in a hurry, she waited another 15 to 20 minutes before picking up Adnan up from the library. And if we shift to Debbie, the state clearly argued to the jury in opening and closing statements that Hay was supposed to pick up her cousin at Campfield at 3 o'clock p.m., if not earlier. And so again, Debbie's testimony was that she saw Hay by the gym starting at 3 o'clock p.m., talked to her for a few minutes. After that, Hay would have had to walk to her car, drive over to the library, and then pick up Adnan to give him a ride. And under this timeline, when she's talking to Debbie, she's already late to pick up her cousin. And so overall, this doesn't make much sense. And plus, the state's linchpin is there's this 2:36 p.m. come and get me call. And so Asia's testimony that she saw Adnan until 2:40 would refute that being a possibility. So overall, the second argument seems like it'll fall on deaf ears on the unreasonable performance prong. And if you think about it, in terms of proving prejudice, this is the state acknowledging a huge gap in their case, and this could really cut against their arguments in appeal.
The state's third argument is the collusion argument resurrected. So according to the state, Gutierrez could have taken all the evidence she had and concluded that Adnan and Asia had cooked up an alibi defense that would have poisoned the case against Adnan if it was presented at trial. In support of this and its other arguments, the state cited two legal authorities, a 1964 law review article and a 1981 opinion of the Court of Appeals of Maryland. Notably, both of these authorities predated the Supreme Court opinion that set forth the current test for ineffective assistance of counsel. But more importantly, the state continues to miss the point. These authorities discuss the ethical and practical problems with presenting false alibi evidence. But these authorities both assume that defense counsel has contacted the alibi witness and determined her alibi to be false. All of the cases cited by Judge Welch stand for the proposition that such a determination can't be made without first contacting the alibi witness. And that's why the state has almost no shot at getting the Court of Special Appeals to reverse Judge Welch's finding that Gutierrez acted unreasonably in failing to contact Asia McClain. The state's only real shot on this claim is to get the Court of Special Appeals to remand the case back down to Judge Welch again, because they have a couple of witnesses, these two sisters, that they say could testify that Asia said she was going to make up an alibi for Adnan. But while the court hasn't yet rejected the state's invitation, Maryland law states that only defendants can file motions to reopen, so it's unclear how the state could get testimony from these sisters on the record.
If the state's going to win on the Asia issue, then they're going to win on the prejudice prong, which takes us to Judge Welch's second legal conclusion. According to Judge Welch, the failure to contact Asia wasn't prejudicial for two reasons. One, the state's case did not rest in the time of the murder because, quote, the state presented a relatively weak theory of the murder based upon inconsistent facts. Specifically, while the state claimed that the come-and-get-me call came at 2:36 p.m., Jay testified that the call actually came after 3:45 p.m. And two, Asia's testimony wouldn't have undermined the crux of the state's case, which consisted of the intersection between Jay's testimony about the burial and the Lincoln Park pings. In other words, Judge Welch felt the state's theory of what happened during the early afternoon had so many flaws and inconsistencies already that it couldn't have been what led the jury to convict Adnan. In his brief to the Court of Special Appeals, Justin made several arguments against this conclusion. First, he cited several cases where courts quickly concluded that the failure to call alibi witnesses who contradicted the state's crime timeline was prejudicial. Second, he noted that Judge Welch cited no cases in contradiction and that the state has cited no such cases. Third, he quoted authority for the claim that a weakness in the state's case makes it easier, not tougher, to prove prejudice. And fourth, and maybe most importantly, he pointed to the recent opinion in Weary v. Cain, where the U.S. Supreme Court found that evidence that further weakened an already weak case of the defendant's involvement in a murder was prejudicial, notwithstanding arguably strong evidence of the defendant's post-murder involvement. This is because it's the murder that's the crux of a murder case, meaning Lincoln Park pings, which are tied not to the murder but to the burial, can't be the crux of the case against Adnan. And now, with the state's acknowledgement of a new flaw in their theory of the murder, this argument becomes even stronger.
Somewhat surprisingly, the state addressed neither Judge Welch's conclusions or the defense arguments head-on in their brief. Instead, at the end of their brief, the state set forth all the evidence against Adnan and claimed that the case was strong enough to support a conviction even with Asia's testimony and without the Lincoln Park pings. This seems like the state trying to use a hammer when a scalpel is needed, and we'll discuss this argument in more detail toward the end of the episode. Regardless, Judge Welch found that Gutierrez's failure to contact Asia was unreasonable, but not prejudicial. So in essence, Adnan lost in that point, and inertia is on the state's side. But for now, let's turn to the second issue. The second issue is this. Did Adnan receive ineffective assistance of counsel based on Gutierrez's failure to cross-examine the state's cell tower expert with the AT&T disclaimer, the facts cover sheet? This, of course, is the disclaimer that indicated that incoming calls are not reliable for determining location. Again, we have to break down this issue into Judge Welch's factual findings and then legal conclusions. In this appeal, we had what's known as a battle of experts, with FBI agent Chad Fitzgerald testifying for the state and Gerald Grant testifying for the defense, and Abe Ronowitz, the state's cell tower expert from the trial, submitting two affidavits for the defense. But in Judge Welch's estimation, all three of these experts actually supported the defense. Here are a few of Judge Welch's factual findings.
1. The court is perplexed by Agent Fitzgerald's interpretation that Exhibit 31 are call detail records and not a subscriber activity report because the agent's interpretation is contrary to the text of petitioner's cell phone records. 2. Contrary to Agent Fitzgerald's claim that the set of instructions in the disclaimer do not apply to Exhibit 31, the instructions do apply to Exhibit 31. 3. While Fitzgerald initially claimed that the term location, referenced in the disclaimer, did not refer to the cell site location and instead referred to the location of the switch in the location 1 column, when presented with the helicopter call, quote, he affirmed that the cell site information reflected in the unredacted subscriber activity report may not be reliable. And finally, 4. Therefore, the term location specified in the disclaimer refers to the cell site location and thus the disclaimer applies to Exhibit 31.
Again, these are all factual findings, meaning that the Court of Special Appeals will only reverse them if it finds them to be, quote, clearly erroneous. So this then takes us to Judge Welch's two legal conclusions. His first was that Gutierrez acted unreasonably in failing to cross-examine the state cell tower expert with this disclaimer. As support for his conclusion, Judge Welch cited several opinions where courts had found that failure to properly cross-examine expert witnesses can be unreasonable. One of these cases was a Court of Appeals of Maryland case, where defense counsel failed to properly cross-examine the state's expert or otherwise present evidence that hairs recovered from a victim were not a match for the defendant's hair. In its brief, the state mainly has four responses to this legal conclusion. First, the state cited precedent noting that it's difficult to find unreasonable performance based on faulty cross-examination. But the state failed to note that this precedent dealt with lay witnesses, with faulty cross-examination of expert witnesses often being the basis for reversal. Second, the state noted that the cases cited by Judge Welch and the defense all dealt with attorneys making several errors, as opposed to just errors in cross-examining witnesses. This is true. And if the state ultimately wins this argument on appeal, it will be because the Court of Special Appeals is able to distinguish these cases. But as Justin notes in his brief, the state failed to cite a case where a court found that an isolated claim of failure to properly cross-examine an expert was reasonable. And while there were several errors by trial counsel in the Maryland case cited by Judge Welch, he found unreasonable performance on the expert evidence issue alone before proceeding to consider the other errors as an alternate ground for a new trial. Listeners of Undisclosed, I am here to let you in on a little secret, and it is going to be your new not-so-guilty pleasure. Now, if you like me, you like to shop, but you like a bargain. So let me share with you the secret to scoring 90% off top brands. Check out ThredUp. At ThredUp, you can score an Anthropologie top for $12, Lululemon pants for $60, and Steve Madden wedges for $19. ThredUp is the world's largest online thrift store. You experience the thrill of thrifting with none of the hassle. They add over 15,000 items to their site every single day, and that gives you thousands of ways to give your wardrobe the style update that it deserves. And unlike in a real thrift shop where you're just going to be endlessly sorting through stuff, on ThredUp, you can actually search by your favorite brands. So whether it's Old Navy, Zara, Coach, Gap, J. Crew, Anthropologie, you can filter by size, color, price, and style to easily find what you're looking for. Every single item is triple inspected by hand, which ensures only the highest quality styles. And when you place your order, all of your like-new treasures are going to arrive neatly folded and packaged in ThredUp's signature polka dot box. ThredUp offers free shipping on qualified orders and easy returns. So head over to ThredUp.com today to save up to 90% off retail on your favorite brands. Plus, right now, if you go to ThredUp.com/undisclosed, you get an extra 40% off. 40% off your first order. ThredUp.com, that is spelled ThredUp.com/undisclosed. Go there right now and you get an extra 40% off right now if you go to ThredUp.com/undisclosed.
The state's third argument was that Gutierrez was actually quite effective in emasculating the state's cell tower evidence, and that an attempt to use the AT&T disclaimer might have derailed that strategy. Now, there's actually the germ of an interesting argument there, but Justin really took the wind out of the state's sails by noting that Gutierrez's supposed victory was actually a failure. The heart of the state's argument was that Gutierrez was able to secure a limiting instruction, informing jurors that the cell tower pings were only admissible to corroborate Jay's testimony and not admissible as substantive evidence of the location of Adnan's cell phone. And while that distinction might be tough to explain, it's an important distinction, and legally speaking, one that courts assume that jurors respected. But the jurors could only do that if they were in fact given the limiting instruction, and this is where Gutierrez's failure comes into play. While the judge agreed to give a limiting instruction and asked for both sides to draft proposed language, no limiting instruction in Adnan's case was actually ever given. Now, we're not sure exactly what happened. Maybe Gutierrez never complied with the judge's request, but we know for sure is that Gutierrez never objected to the judge failing to give a limiting instruction. This not only makes it easier for the defense to prove unreasonable performance, it also makes it easier for them to prove prejudice. Now, the state's fourth and final argument comes down to the Supreme Court's recent opinion in Maryland versus Kolbicki. This is the case that reached the Supreme Court after the Court of Appeals of Maryland found that trial counsel in a murder case was ineffective in failing to use a report authored by the state's comparative bullet lead analysis expert to cross-examine him at trial. On appeal, the Supreme Court reversed and found that trial counsel was not ineffective, and in Adnan's case, of course, the state has extensively cited to Kolbicki in both its briefs to Judge Welch and the Court of Special Appeals. But there are two key differences between Adnan's case and the Kolbicki case. First, as Judge Welch found, Gutierrez was provided with the AT&T disclaimer, whereas the Supreme Court found in Kolbicki that the report was sort of a needle in a haystack that defense counsel probably wouldn't have found even with a diligent search. And second, more importantly, the AT&T disclaimer plainly said, incoming calls are not reliable for determining location. While the expert's report in Kolbecki did raise some concerns about comparative bullet lead analysis, but ultimately concluded it was reliable. In fact, this type of forensic evidence was considered reliable and routinely used until 8 years after Kolbecki's trial. Therefore, it seems Kolbecki is pretty readily distinguishable from Renaud's case. That said, it must be acknowledged this is a question mark. That's because there's two responses that state's courts can have to being reversed by the Supreme Court in appeal. Double down or capitulate. Court of Special Appeals could do either in this case. They could think the Supreme Court overreacted and be eager to establish new precedent, making it clear that defendants are entitled to new trials when their counsel fails in connection with expert evidence. Or, on the other hand, they could decide that they themselves have gone too far and fall in the lockstep with the Supreme Court by circumscribing the right to effective assistance of counsel in connection with expert evidence. So while it seems like the defense has a pretty strong argument for distinguishing Kolbecki, there's at least the chance that the court has no interest in limiting that opinion to its facts, and therefore, there's at least a decent chance the state might win this argument in appeal.
So having found that Christina Gutierrez was unreasonable for failing to cross-examine the state's witness on the cell tower evidence, the next step in the analysis, just like in the Asian analysis, is whether that failure was prejudicial to Adnan. On this issue, Judge Welch found that it was prejudicial. And had Gutierrez been effective, there would have been reasonable probability of a different outcome. In other words, the jury may have rendered a not guilty verdict. A finding of prejudice is related to the total strength of the state's case. In other words, was there enough other evidence of guilt offered that this evidence alone was not determinative of the outcome? Well, Judge Welch didn't think so. He denied the Asia issue precisely because he thought that the crux of the state's case was the Lincoln Park pings. The state challenged this finding by arguing, rather remarkably, that, quote, Syed mischaracterizes and overstates the significance of cell tower evidence. The state says, prejudice simply cannot be shown in a case with the quality and kind of overwhelming evidence of guilt presented at Syed's trial. And they lay out the following evidence against Adnan, which they argue, even without the Lincoln Park pings, would have been enough to convict him. Number one, motive. The state argues that Hay noted Adnan was possessive and jealous in her diary, that she kept her interest in Don, her new boyfriend, a secret from Adnan, that she had become newly intimate and public in her relationship with her new boyfriend, and also that Jay testified that Adnan told him he intended to kill Hay. And then finally, that the police found the I will kill note in Adnan's room. So the state's arguing all of these things establish motive. Second, preparation. The state argues that Adnan had purchased a new cell phone the day before Hay was killed, and he asked Jay to hold the phone and car to assist him, and that Adnan was overheard asking Hay for a ride. Third, accomplice testimony, although Jay was really not an accomplice. But the state argues that Jay led the police to Hay's car and that he saw Hay's body in Lincoln Park and that he assisted in burying her. Then they go to corroboration. They say that three witnesses for the state, Christy Vinson, Jen Pusateri, and Nisha Tanna, put Jay and Adnan together after track practice. And then Jen met Jay and Adnan in a parking lot where Jay told her Adnan had strangled Hay. Then they cite forensics, and they argue that Adnan's palm print on the back of a map book in Hay's car is forensic evidence. They also say that the anonymous phone call telling police to call Yasser Ali is also forensic evidence, though it's not. And they also say that Adnan called Yasser Ali twice on January 13th, and they say that's also forensic evidence. And again, that's not exactly forensic evidence. But lastly, they say the deviations in Adnan's story were also evidence of his guilt. And to support that argument, they say that Adnan originally told the police that he asked for a ride from Hay. Then later he told the police he didn't. That he told the police he went to track practice after school originally. Then later he said he didn't recall what he did that day. And that he never tried to contact Hay after she disappeared. Although we know that's not exactly a deviation in the story. Now here's the thing. We have done dozens and dozens of undisclosed episodes and many blog posts between the three of us that have all debunked the so-called evidence, both before and after the state filed this brief. So we're not going to spend time debunking these points. But if you do want a concise unpacking, I urge you to check out Colin's blog. Just Google the Evidence Professor blog. And this blog is titled The Case Against Adnan Syed Redux. So the state argues in their conclusion in the brief that, quote, this is the evidence without the cell phone data that is the subject of Syed's challenge. This not only confirms that time of death was hardly a key factor of the state's case, it also makes clear that even if all the location data corresponding to incoming and outgoing calls was absent, it is unreasonable to conclude that a jury would have returned a different verdict. Thus, in light of the state's unimpeached evidence, neither alleged error can form the basis alone of prejudice warranting a new trial.
Yeah, I think the state's really between a rock and a hard place in terms of these arguments, and it'll be interesting to see whether they can sort it out during oral arguments before the Court of Special Appeals, because to the extent they try to undermine the importance of the cell tower pings, that only makes Asia's alibi testimony more important, and to the extent they try to undermine the importance of that alibi testimony again, it only makes the cell tower pings all the more important. And the state's really going to have to thread a needle during oral arguments, and I'm not sure that they can present a coherent theory to the judges to ensure that they find that neither of these are important and therefore find a lack of prejudice on either of these cases.
Well, you know, a couple of things to note about what you just said, Colin. Number one, the state is presenting these kind of, you know, evidentiary arguments against Adnan based on the facts they presented at the trial, right? So when they say unimpeached evidence, well, a lot of it has been impeached much later, like in the last couple of years, but they're looking at this case like as a time capsule. So they're not looking at the fact that Jay has changed his statements again, that there's lividity evidence that other things, you know, have disproven some of this stuff. But here's what I wonder. I mean, you say that the state will have trouble threading this needle, but won't it really depend on how much these judges know about the facts of the case? I mean, when I recited that list of evidence, if you don't know exactly what happened then and how inconsistent even in 1999 and 2000 this evidence was, or so-called evidence was, and how much has been done since, it can seem pretty convincing. And I don't think the Court of Special Appeals is going to know the facts of the case as well as, let's say, our listeners do or we do.
Right. And that's why I think it'll be very important that these oral arguments for the defense to make clear, look, Judge Welch found there's a huge problem with the state's timeline. Jay said he got the come and get me call after 3:45 p.m. and there's no matching call, so that couldn't have taken place. But the state, of course, claims this happened at 2:36 p.m. Well, now Asia's alibi takes it to 2:40 p.m., so that knocks out the come and get me call altogether. We have the inconsistency in the timeline based upon Jay's story versus the state's story, and now the state itself has acknowledged that both Inez Butler and Debbie saw Hay alone after school. And really, at trial, the state hung its hat in Inez Butler, and Inez says, I saw Hay run up to the concession stand between 2:15 and 2:20 p.m. She was in such a hurry to leave, she didn't even have time to pay for what she bought. So the state has Hay leaving school in a hurry by herself between 2:20 and 2:25 p.m., which is about 15 to 20 minutes before Asia leaves Adnan behind at the library. So the state basically is throwing everything at the wall to see what sticks, I think the defense really needs to focus on these two big problems. One identified by Judge Welch, one identified by the state, and argue to the Court of Special Appeals, these problems made the state's case so weak that correct handling of Asia or the cell tower pings likely would have changed the outcome at trial.
And that brings us to issues 3 and 4. Did Judge Welch exceed the scope of the remand order in considering the cell tower claim, and or was this whole claim waived? These issues are kind of overlapping, and it's not clear which body of law Judge Welch will apply to each issue, but let's break down a few different sub-issues here that the Court of Special Appeals will be considering. First, what was the scope of its own remand order? What was it asking the trial court to do, and did the trial court follow that instruction? The state notes that the remand was called a limited remand, and that the Court of Special Appeals would allow supplementing of the record with evidence, quote, pertinent to the issues raised on appeal. They claimed, then, that only evidence connected to Asia could have been heard, and that when the court heard evidence related to the cell phone evidence or other matters, that was exceeding the scope and should not have been allowed. In response, Justin has argued that the remand order said that Judge Welch could conduct any further proceedings he deemed appropriate and take any action he deemed appropriate. Like Judge Welch, Justin believes this gave authority to consider the cell tower issue, and this question will be resolved under an abuse of discretion standard, which means even if the Court of Special Appeals intended to limit the scope of remand, the court won't reverse here unless it believes that Judge Welch's interpretation of the order was unreasonable. In other words, if Judge Welch acted reasonably in deciding that the court's language gave him authority to hear the cell phone evidence, then even if the Court of Special Appeals hadn't actually meant it that way, because it worded it the way it did, there was no abuse of discretion, and what Judge Welch did is allowed.
Can I ask, I mean, and I don't remember if I might be misremembering, but wasn't the cell phone issue raised in a brief by the state to Judge Welch after it was remanded and then it opened the door and just responded to it? Or am I misremembering that?
They were the first one to bring it up in part of this. And in response, Justin did bring up
the facts cover sheet,
the other problems in the state's case.
Yeah, this was the claim by the state that if Asia had testified, they could have shifted the come and get me call from 236 to 315. And of course, Judge Welch shot that down. But yeah, one of Justin's arguments was that opened the door for us to present that. That is a possibility that the Court of Special Appeals could say, well, actually, the state opened the door to this.
Yeah, if the state could have argued during the hearing that, oh, actually, the cell phone evidence shows that it doesn't matter what Asia said, then it would be unfair and overly restrictive to say, you know what, in response, Anand's not permitted to argue the cell phone evidence. So the second part of this issue is that the state's claim that Curtis no longer makes sense here in 2017. Back in 1978, when it was decided, a defendant could file unlimited PCR petitions. Now, under the current rules, they only get one. Therefore, the state says that this court should abandon Curtis to protect finality and to preclude defendants from having too many bites of the appellate apple. What the state hasn't mentioned here, though, is an equally important development under Maryland law. Back in 2002, the Court of Special Appeals found in Stovall v. State that a defendant has the right to effective assistance of post-conviction counsel. So if a defendant can establish that he would have won his PCR petition but for his deficient counsel, then he gets to reopen his PCR petition and get a new trial. Therefore, the state's arguments about finality and bites at the apple are incorrect. Even if the court closed the Curtis door, the defendant could still get just as many bites at the apple by claiming that his post-conviction counsel failed to advise him of a viable claim of ineffective assistance.
The state's third argument is that even if Curtis's intelligent and knowing waiver standard still applies, it should only apply in cases where there is an in-court colloquy between the judge and the defendant on the issue. So let's break that down. What Curtis said was if you have a fundamental right, that right can only be waived through intelligent and knowing waiver. In other words, the defendant had to be made aware of this right and with that knowledge have waived that right. And what the court found, Judge Welch found, was basically intelligent and knowing waiver applies to ineffective assistance of counsel. And what the state is claiming now is, no, we should limit this to cases where you had to have a discussion between the judge and the defendant in court. And if that discussion didn't take place, then in that case, Curtis would apply. But if it's just an attorney discussing a right with a defendant, it shouldn't apply here. And so the state's claim is, here are cases where we applied Curtis in Maryland and there was an in-court colloquy. And that, by the absence of cases to the contrary, means it doesn't apply in cases without a colloquy. And Justin's response is, well, it's true the state has cited these cases. None of these cases found that an in-court colloquy is a prerequisite, and there's no reason to limit Curtis in this way. And I think overall, Justin is right that to this point, Maryland courts have not reached this conclusion. That said, if Theroux is able to make a convincing argument that the court should restrict it in this way, this is potentially a winning argument for the state, but it would require, again, Theroux to convince Maryland to create new law.
The next sub-issue relates to what's called the law of the case doctrine. The law of the case doctrine says that a defendant can't relitigate issues that have already been decided and can't bring new claims that could have already been raised. A big question is when the law of the case doctrine takes effect, because the state has claimed that the doctrine took effect here after Judge Welch's initial opinion back in 2014. They've cited a case called Arrington and said that case means that both the law of the case doctrine and the Uniform Post-Conviction Procedure Act bar the cell tower claim. The defense has responded that neither of these take effect until the Court of Special Appeals rules on the merits of a PCR petition, which didn't happen here because the Court of Special Appeals remanded the case back to Judge Welch. The defense has relied upon a case called Poole that says a defendant can, quote, freely amend a PCR petition before it's been resolved. But the state claims that the PCR petition was resolved because a motion to reopen is done to reopen a closed proceeding. In response, the defense says that the limitations on PCR filings only apply to filings that, quote, begin a proceeding. And that's not the case here, because as Judge Welch found, the Court of Special Appeals remanded the case to him with explicit instructions to send the case back up when it was done. It could be said, then, that the reopened PCR proceeding was a continuation of the prior proceeding and not a new proceeding. Overall, this one's going to be tough to decide, and I don't think anyone knows where the Court of Special Appeals is going to come down. That said, it's a pretty safe bet that if the court relies on Arrington, the state will win, and if it relies on Poole, the defense will win. Finally, it's important to note that if the case does come down to waiver, Maryland Court Rule 8-131A allows the Court of Special Appeals to excuse waiver. So, even if the court finds that Anon waived the cell tower claim, it could actually still excuse that waiver and consider the merits of Judge Welch's conclusion. And if it does that, it's tough to see the court reversing Judge Welch, which leaves us with only one final issue.
And that is, was Gutierrez ineffective in failing to ask the state about a plea bargain? Yeah, you guys may have forgotten about it, but the claim that initially led the Court of Special Appeals to grant Adnan leave to appeal back in 2015 was this claim, that while Adnan asked Gutierrez to inquire into a plea deal with the state, she never followed through. While the case law is very good for the defense on the alibi and cell tower claims, it's very bad on the plea bargain claim. Not so much on their unreasonable performance. There is some case law out there indicating that failing to ask about a plea bargain can be unreasonable. But the precedent on prejudice is pretty uniform. A defendant can only win on such a claim if he can establish that he would have accepted a plea deal offered by the state. And courts routinely hold the defendant who continues to maintain his innocence would not have taken a plea deal. Now, factually speaking, this isn't really true. Studies have shown that innocent defendants take plea deals all the time, but legally speaking, it means that this claim is pretty much dead in the water. That said, the court did grant Adnan leave to appeal on this issue, so there's always a chance. But a chance at what? Even if the court found for Adnan on the issue, it's unclear what the relief would be.
I'll start with my thoughts. I've said since my first blog post in this case, ineffective assistance for failing to ask about a plea bargaining, I think, is a losing argument and is not going to take the day. I think on the Asia claim, I don't see any realistic chance the Court of Special Appeals reverses the finding of unreasonable performance. On the cell tower issue, I don't see any way in which the Court of Special Appeals reverses the prejudice finding. And that leaves us with scope, waiver, prejudice on Asia, and unreasonable performance on cell tower. I think the defense has a pretty strong argument on unreasonable performance, especially with Gutierrez not getting the limiting instruction. The only worry there is Kolbicki being extended, but I think that it's pretty distinguishable. On the Asia alibi issue, I think the state made a big mistake in acknowledging the flaw in the state's case with the two witnesses seeing Hay alone after school. It's a little closer than I'd like, but I think the defense is a pretty good argument there to win on prejudice. Scope, I think I would have a tough time seeing the Court of Special Appeals finding that Judge Welch abused his discretion. Even if he did, I don't see a reason to reverse in that ground. It would just mean we have further proceedings down the road. The biggest question mark for me is this waiver issue, and in all my research, it seems there are some gaps in the law there in Maryland, and that's the one question mark I have. Court of Special Appeals, of course, could excuse waiver, but that's the one big worry I have in this case is, will the court find waiver? And I'm not 100% convinced that the defense is going to take the day on this, but I think they have the stronger argument.
What does it mean if they find waiver? It means that basically any cell tower claim, it's just gone. So we're left with the plea bargain and Asia issue, yes?
Right, for this appeal, but as we just noted a minute ago, that could still leave the door open for a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, which of course would extend the clock and have further proceedings, but at least in this hearing, it would mean, right, the issue can't be considered.
Yeah, and again, I would not be shocked if what we come out of from the Court of Special Appeals is a decision where Anon wins on the Asia issue and loses on the cell tower issue. And then we're going up to the Court of Appeals.
Right. This is not the final level of appeals. In Maryland, we have the highest court, which is the Court of Appeals. And I'm assuming whoever loses on whatever issue will continue to challenge this. Although there is a part of me that hopes if the state loses, they just decide that they will give up.
They won't give up. No, they're not.
When you have pro bono prosecutor, I guess there's no reason to give up.
And as we see from Kolbicki, we could have an appeal to the Supreme Court. This could go all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court eventually.
Right. Well, Susan, are you planning to be at the hearing on June 8th?
I am very much hoping. We'll see how that works out.
Okay. I will definitely be there. I'll be there with Adnan's family and his attorney. The hearing should not last more than, I think, an hour. Is that right? I think it's like a 1 hour argument. It's not like the PCR where it's going to go on and on.
Right. Yeah. I think it's usually about 20 minutes per side, but they might get more here because of the cross appeal. And so I think I've seen some things online that it might be extended to 30 minutes a side or maybe 40 minutes a side. But yeah, not much more than an hour.
I believe that it takes 3 to 4 months to get a ruling then, but I don't think that's like, a hard and fast rule. But I think the last time we were before the Court of Special Appeals, if I'm remembering correctly, it took around that amount of time. And if it keeps getting appealed further, obviously this can go on for another year or two. Colin, what do you think are the chances of renewing the bail motion?
Well, in essence, as you noted, Judge Welch said, I can't rule on the bail issue because I was told to send this case back up to the Court of Special Appeals. So absolutely, if the Court of Special Appeals either affirms or, as Susan said, reverses on cell tower but gives it non-relief on the Asia issue, at that moment, Justin could certainly renew the motion for bail and now say, look, the Intermediate Appellate Court has affirmed this. And there's not even a guarantee the Court of Appeals grants cert, and so you should grant bail. And right, the moment that they decided in his favor, they could renew that motion.
Well, I will say this, that there are things that even Justin's not sure about until they are actually unfolding, because there seems to be like a lot of case of first instances in this case. One thing I did want to note is that while people are asking what's happening in the case legally, and yeah, it is moving slowly. It's going to move slowly. Adnan knows it's going to move slowly. Any defendant in this situation understands that. And believe me, he's completely mentally prepared, even more so than probably his family and supporters on the outside. We feel much more urgency because it's just frustrating after all this many years that he is still behind bars. He is in a good mental place because he's just being patient and he thinks that one day this is going to come to pass, whether it takes months or years. But I do want to say this, that there is an investigation, and I've mentioned this before, that's ongoing on the facts of the case, on what actually happened on January 13th. It continues. We continue to get information every so often that if we were to go back to trial, could really, really damage the state's case. We have people who continue to come forward. So I want folks to know that a lot is happening in this case, even though we're not obviously publicly discussing it. And one day it'll all come to light. So we will be back on Thursday with another special episode in which Susan is going to update us on what's going on in Joey's case and a recent hearing at the Supreme Court of Georgia based on a claim filed by us, undisclosed. So join us in a couple of days and we'll update you on the state versus Joey Watkins.
Special update of Undisclosed was produced by Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media and the two great podcasts, Crime Writers On and These Are Their Stories. Our great sponsors this week were The Skim and ThreadUp. Listeners, please go check out those great products. As an independent podcast, sponsorship is necessary for us to make sure we can continue to produce Undisclosed for you and that you get it for free. Great sponsors make for great podcasts, so please check them out. Patrick Cortez and Ramiro Marquez composed Undisclosed theme music. Nina Mooser and Christy Williams design and maintain our website. That website is www.undisclosed-podcast.com, and Baluki does our graphics. You can find us on social media using our handle at Undisclosed Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Don't forget to visit us again on Thursday at 6 p.m. for an additional update episode. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed's executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Thursday for another Undisclosed Update episode. Until then,